This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Folks, it is time to talk about one of my absolute favorite topics, snacks. Japanese snacks, specifically. You know, ever since I was a young lad who discovered the world of Japanese snacks, I've been obsessed with their adorable packaging, quirky vibes, and the incredible flavors that you just cannot find in U.S. supermarkets. That is why teaming up with our sponsor, Boxu, a Japanese snack subscription box, has been an absolute blast. Because these snacks aren't just your average grocery store finds. Every month, Boxu delivers over 20 unique treats straight from Japan. Plus, they include a handy guide filled with info about each snack and Japanese culture. Snacking and learning, literally my two favorite things, and I'm going to take a wild guess that those are two things you enjoy as well. Oh, and did I mention that each box ships free from Japan straight to your doorstep? It's incredible. And these snacks are so special, okay? One of them that I just cannot get out of my mind, they have this white chocolate strawberry. It's like a freeze-dried strawberry that is somehow injected with white chocolate. So it is both simultaneously strawberry and white chocolate. I cannot even describe to you what this tasted like. I have never had a textural or taste sensation like it. You gotta try it. And my favorite thing about Boxu, besides the amazing snacks, is that they support small, family-run businesses in Japan. Boxu has sourced your treats by working with over 245 small makers in Japan, helping out their businesses and helping to preserve their traditions. So if you love Japanese snacks as much as I do, or if you know someone who does, you have got to try out Boxu. Right now, you can use the code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. That's FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. And let me know what you think of that strawberry. It is seriously good.
I don't know the truth.
Welcome to Factually. I'm Adam Conover. Thank you so much for joining me once again as I talk to an incredible expert about all the amazing things that they know that I don't know and that you might not know. Both of our minds are going to get blown together. We're going to have so much fun doing it. And by the way, we are here in our brand new studio recording both audio and video. If you're listening to the show on your favorite podcast player, go check out my YouTube channel. If you're watching on YouTube, hey, maybe subscribe to the podcast. We have an amazing show for you every single week. And this week, we're talking about police violence and accountability. See, for years, we have been bombarded with stories and videos of cops killing and abusing people they should not have, especially Black and brown people. And part of what makes this so offensive and upsetting to all of us is that this is the cops doing the opposite of their job, right? I mean, we're told that cops are supposed to protect us and protect our constitutional rights, not violate them on a massive scale. Yet somehow, cops never seem to get in trouble for doing this. Darren Wilson, the officer who shot and killed Michael Brown in Ferguson, never charged. Daniel Pantaleo, who with other NYPD officers killed Eric Garner, never charged. And the two Buffalo officers who brutally pushed over a 75-year-old Black Lives Matter protester and left him bleeding out on the street? You guessed it, they had their charges dropped. Now, the exception that proves the rule to this is Derek Chauvin, who murdered George Floyd. But he was only convicted after sparking one of the largest civil rights uprisings in American history. But you know, the cops shoot to death about 1,000 people a year. And if just 2% of those are obviously unjustified, well, that would be about 20 mass protests annually we have to wage just to get a little bit of justice. And I do not think we can march that much. You know, if I fail at my job, people don't laugh, or maybe I get fired from doing my TV show. I face immediate accountability, but somehow the cops, who are charged with keeping us safe and upholding the law and Constitution, never face any accountability whatsoever. Why is that? Well, as it turns out, police impunity is written into our laws. You would think that when a cop violates your rights, you'd be able to sue them for their abuse, right? Well, wrong. There's a legal doctrine called qualified immunity, which makes it nearly impossible to hold police accountable when they violate your rights. Starting from rulings in the 1960s, qualified immunity sets the bar absurdly high for a plaintiff to prove that a cop has violated their rights. Justice Sonia Sotomayor calls it an absolute shield, which tells officers that they can shoot first and think later, and it tells the public that palpably unreasonable conduct will go unpunished. I mean, how nuts is that? If cops seem to act like they're unaccountable to anyone ever, it's because to a great extent, they are. And unfortunately, qualified immunity isn't even the final word of police impunity in America. It's just the opening salvo. Police are protected not just by the law, but by the structure of our court system itself, and crucially, by other cops. And to help us pick apart this web of impunity, we have an incredible guest today. But before we get to her, I want to remind you that if you want to support this show, head to patreon.com/Adam Conover. Just $5 a month gets you every episode of this podcast ad-free. You can join our community Discord. We would love to have you. And if you want to support me personally, I want to remind you I am going on tour. If you want to see my stand-up tour dates, head to adamconover.net for tickets. I would love to see you there. I do a meet and greet after every show. We can take a little selfie. It'll be really nice. But now let's get to our guest. We have an incredible one for you this week. Her name is Joanna Schwartz. She's a law professor at UCLA, and she's the author of Shielded: How the Police Became Untouchable. Please welcome Joanna Schwartz. Joanna, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you have a new book out called Shielded: How the Police Became Untouchable. This book opens with a shocking story. There's a group of police officers in Atlanta. They are about to do a no-knock raid. They have a warrant. Only one of them reads the warrant. He doesn't read it all the way through. They end up going to the wrong house, which they wouldn't have if they had read the thing that they were supposed to do. They bust into this house. They find an 80-year-old man thereabouts. They throw him on the ground. He has a heart condition. He starts having a heart episode. They arrest him. Eventually, it's all cleared up and they find out that they weren't supposed to arrest this man. And then the shocking thing is nothing else happens, right? Like if I were to fuck up that badly or anything close to that badly at any job, I would at the very least be fired, right? If I were to harm a person like this, I would be culpable to some degree, even if I was doing it as the course of my job, because this is like basic competence, right? Lack of negligence. And yet nothing happened to these police officers. Why was that? Why? Oh, and by the way, this is something that we're very familiar with from watching police doing basically anything in America. This happens daily. We're all aware of this. Why are the police so unaccountable? And what does that story tell us about why they are?
Well, they're unaccountable because each of the kinds of avenues that we have for some kind of justice in these cases doesn't work very well. I mean, there's really sort of three kinds of avenues to some kind of justice. One is that officers could be criminally prosecuted. They virtually never are. And why? Because district attorneys, prosecutors are unlikely to want to bring charges against the officers who they're reliant upon to get convictions in other cases.
It's politically difficult.
Absolutely. Yeah. Internal affairs, investigations, and discipline and firings is another avenue. And police reformers police officials all the time say, we don't need outside oversight because we can police our own. Well, that doesn't work. And again, there are lots of reasons why police unions have become so powerful and protected essentially officers from getting any kind of punishment or consequence from within the department. And so then what we're left with, and what Henri Norris, the person whose story I told in the beginning of the book, is left with, is filing a lawsuit seeking some sort of damages or forward-looking relief. But that path is almost unpassable also, because the Supreme Court and state and local governments across the country have created multiple barriers to relief out of made up concerns about the dangers of too much justice in these cases. And so a person like Henri Norris, who clearly had his rights violated, who any one of us who had that happen to them would think that they were deserving of something more than the officers just coming and, you know, nailing their door.
This is like what a lawsuit is for. An organization falsely accused me of doing XYZ. They threw me on the ground. They harmed me. They hurt me. I had medical bills. I was afraid for my life. This is literally the point of a lawsuit. And yet it's somehow impossible for a lawsuit to work against police in this way. So I want to talk about all these avenues.
Yeah.
But let's talk about that last one first, because this sounds like the most interesting one. What you say, the Supreme Court has put in place made up concerns that prevent us from successfully suing police officers who are grossly incompetent or malicious and hurt innocent people.
or hurt people of any type.
Yes.
What are those concerns? How did this happen?
Well, so to understand how this all happened, you actually have to zoom back to 1871, to the years after the Civil War. During Reconstruction, Congress created the right to sue for violations of constitutional rights. And they created that right to sue because the Ku Klux Klan and other white supremacist groups were terrorizing Black people around the South, particularly, and state and local governments were doing nothing, or they're participating in the violence themselves. So Congress said, we need to have this right to sue. We need to have this forum for people to get some kind of justice. And then the Supreme Court really quickly said, you know, interpreted the statute and interpreted the Constitution in all sorts of ways that made it really difficult to sue. Then you get to 19.
Let me just ask. I'm sorry. If these laws were passed in order to, you know, fight the Ku Klux Klan, fight, you know, the militarized forces of white supremacy, the remnants of the Confederate Army, right?
Yep.
And the Supreme Court said, hold on, that's not okay. Was that because the Supreme Court was on the side, like on the side of the Klan? Like, is that the legacy that we're dealing with? Hey, these laws are at least part, you know, pro Ku Klux Klan rulings by the Supreme Court.
Well, the Ku Klux, the Supreme Court never came out and said we support the Ku Klux Klan, right? And this is actually an important point because, you know, the Supreme Court doesn't set out to say we want to deny people's rights, right? They use other language. They use language about the importance of state government, states being able to control themselves, about the concerns of, you know, the federal government infringing upon the rights of states. And also through these sort of kind of ridiculous interpretations that advance these interests, even if they're not saying it. So just as one example, the 14th Amendment, which is, you know, offers equal protection, meaning equal protection to Black people, freed slaves and white people, to challenge the Ku Klux Klan's, you know, terrorism. The Supreme Court interpreted that not to apply to private actors.
Hmm.
So, I mean, the 14th Amendment was created in response, in part, to the violence of private actors. And then the Supreme Court says, no, that can't be what it means.
Yeah.
Are they explicitly saying we want the Ku Klux Klan to terrorize people? No. But is that the sort of obvious, predictable consequence?
It's the effect, and the laws were passed in order to protect Black Americans from the Ku Klux Klan.
Correct.
And so if you're alive at that time period and you're on the Supreme Court and you're saying, actually, I'm going to invalidate that law, you are taking sides in that conflict to some degree. You're saying, actually, that law designed to protect Black Americans from the Ku Klux Klan, it's unconstitutional for a bunch of reasons. You know what you're doing to some extent. We can at least make that presumption. So please continue with the narrative. The Supreme Court at the time, in this period of, you know, white supremacy, decided to invalidate some of these laws. So what happened next?
And through a bunch of decisions, as you're saying, that doesn't explicitly say that's what we're doing, but in effect does that. And so then comes Jim Crow laws throughout the South. Then comes essentially legalized segregation and mistreatment of Black people. Then comes the rise of the civil rights movement. And the Supreme Court, which of course, you know, is changing personnel, judges, justices over the years, starts to think, oh, I guess we need to do some more to protect the constitutional rights of Black people. And in 1961, the Supreme Court first recognized, this is 90 years after that statute was passed, first recognized that people could sue police for violating their constitutional rights under this statute.
Okay, like 100 years later.
90 years, yeah. And it was a case involving very similar, actually, to the facts that I talk about in the introduction of the book. It was a Black family living in Chicago. White police officers came into the house, busted into the house without a warrant, pulled this man, James Monroe, and his wife out of bed in the middle of the night, naked, beat James Monroe, beat his children. And it was all because a white woman had pointed his photo out of a pile of mugshots and said that he had killed her husband. In fact, she and her lover had killed her husband to get his insurance money.
Oh my God.
But James Monroe was pointed out.
This is like a Law and Order episode, plus the most virulent racism imaginable.
Right.
If Law and Order was set in, you know, the Jim Crow South. Okay.
Yes, right. And also very similar to things that we see, you know, unfortunately today. Anyway, yeah. The Supreme Court created that right again, recognized the right that it had, you know, that Congress had passed 90 years before. Again, talking about the importance of having this right to seek justice in the courts. And that, you know, opened the door to these suits being brought for the first time, you know, violations of constitutional rights. But then soon after that, there became concerns that the door to the courthouse was being opened too wide. And the kinds of concerns that were raised then and have been raised in the decades since are that frivolous lawsuits will flood the courts, will bankrupt police officers who were only doing their jobs, maybe made a reasonable mistake in a split second, and that if it's too easy to sue and officers are going to be bankrupted for these split second good faith mistakes, no one will agree to become a police officer, and then we won't have any police, and then chaos will ensue. I mean, that's really a version of that argument has been made over the past 60 years and used repeatedly by the Supreme Court to create barrier after barrier after barrier.
This reminds me of just that argument reminds me a bit of a couple years ago. I covered the McDonald's hot coffee lawsuit on you know, my show Adam Ruins Everything. And, you know, the idea that, oh, frivolous lawsuits are running amok is was at that time like a deliberate strategy of corporate lobbyists and lawyers to, you know, reduce the power of the civil lawsuit against them, where McDonald's had actually grievously injured this woman because they were the coffee was at boiling temperatures. And, you know, it was part of an overall strategy to make it harder for the average citizen to sue companies that are hurting them by creating the impression that, oh, frivolous lawsuits are running amok, which is a thing that people were saying constantly in the 90s and still say today. I didn't realize the same thing, the exact same strategy has been pursued by basically the Supreme Court, by our own government against us in the years since. I mean, what is, maybe there's a little bit of shred of, we could credit that argument a little bit and say maybe there's a shred of truth to it. But on the other hand, the way that you put it makes it really clear to me, we're talking about the state violating our constitutional rights. We're talking about armed officers of the state who have a monopoly on violence, a monopoly on this sort of power. They're the only organization that can burst into your house in the middle of the night and throw you on the ground and step on your neck and put you into a paddy wagon and take away your liberty. And they're doing it to people who they don't have a warrant. In some of the stories we're talking about, they're violating your right to privacy and all of these other rights that are like specifically in the Constitution. And there's no method of redress. They're not fired. They're not criminally prosecuted. And you can't civilly sue them. That seems like a pretty, pretty basic constitutional violations that there needs to be some kind of legal redress for. So where is that argument in the Supreme Court? I'm sorry to get mad so early into the interview.
You know what? It's being mad is the right response to the current state of affairs, because I mean, I think that you framed it just right. People are losing their privacy, their dignity, their liberty, and their lives at the hands of police. And the question that we need to ask as a society is, when that happens, who should bear the cost? Because when there's not a consequence, the cost is just being borne by the person who has lost their lives or their privacy or their liberty or their dignity.
Yeah.
And that is not the system that we should have. And the Supreme Court talks a lot about the need to balance. Of course, they pay a lot of lip service to the need to vindicate rights when they've been violated. Of course, lawsuits are an important tool. However, it's always an and, but, you know, we have to worry about these frivolous cases. We have to worry about bankrupt officers and worry that officers are going to be too distracted and too burdened by being sued, as if that's not just part of what comes with the job of getting a badge and a gun and the authority to end someone's life.
Yeah.
And
it's a responsibility that has some, you know, it has some risk to it. That's what a responsibility is.
Right. I mean, and the idea that we can't burden, you know, burden officers with having to explain what they did to, you know, to offer some sort of explanation, some sort of process to deliver potentially justice to people in these situations is just, it's right to be angry.
Yeah. I mean, there's just, there's this idea, let's move off of this in a second, but just to dwell on it for one more moment, there's this sort of idea that individual police officers should never be held responsible for anything that they do in the line of duty, which again is different from any other occupation other than, I suppose that a similar doctrine might exist in the military. I could imagine that, you know, the just sort of following orders thing. But there's so much individual latitude that individual people have. Individual people make mistakes. Is there any justification for that that makes sense to you? Because to me, it's sort of ludicrous because, I mean, I often think individual responsibility is overemphasized in America. And I think we should look at systemic harms and systemic causes more often. But like, it's still a fundamental American principle that like take responsibility for your actions. Like you are the person with a brain with your finger on the trigger. You know?
Right. Well, and the Supreme Court never has come out and said there should be no consequences. Mm-hmm. Of course, this is a little bit like the discussion that we just had about what happened after the Civil War and Reconstruction, where the sort of center was cut out of the statute. The Supreme Court's never said we shouldn't have any responsibility. What they've said is we need to protect against over deterrence. We need mm-hmm. to protect against too much justice because there's negative consequences of too much justice. But then what the court has done, as I try to outline in the book, is is create so many different overlapping barriers that it makes it virtually impossible. Like, have you heard about the idea of have like a belt and suspenders approach? Like the idea that you need to keep up your pants, you know, you wear a belt and then like doubly sure you mm-hmm. also put on suspenders. It's like the Supreme Court has done belt and suspenders and another pair of suspenders. And, you know,
well, this is what is done anytime rights are being eroded or constrained. Like if you look at, you know, the various times and currently the various places that voting rights are restricted, they never say, oh, we don't want these people to vote. They just say, oh, we want you to present an ID and we think people should need to take a literacy test and this and that and this and that. And then the effect is no Black people in the state vote or whatever it is. So I'm very used to that, looking at, okay, what is the effect of this? Because of course nobody ever comes out and says it. But I mean, it's strange that there's no personal accountability at all when the sort of folks who I feel like the folks who are most defensive about the police are the same folks who say in every other area, oh, personal responsibility is so important. You know, if you don't want the police to come burst into your house, maybe you should think about what, you know, your own personal actions. But they never talk about the police's individual actions. But moving to the systemic piece of it. Why? Let's say we want to. There's never been too much justice, as you say. It's never happened.
I haven't seen
much justice.
I haven't seen it. Yeah.
But let's just admit that point for a second and move on to what about systemically? Like, why do we not have police chiefs thrown out on their ear or, you know, completely reformed when events like this happen? When, again, the state violates citizens' constitutional rights, which is the point of the fucking Constitution.
Yeah. Well, so to take these lawsuits for a second, I mean, first of all, I should say I agree completely that systemic problems are, you know, at the root of all of this. Yeah. And I really resist the whole bad apple officer idea.
Absolutely.
That there's one bad guy out there. You know, the reason that there were 24 officers who raided that Henri Norris's home in the outskirts of Atlanta and only one read the warrant and then nobody was disciplined. That's not a bad apple. That's a rotten barrel or, you know, something much more systemic than that. The Supreme Court, again, wanting to make sure that states' rights are protected and local governments' ability to govern themselves is protected. This is like the same language that you've seen in the Reconstruction after, you know, tearing down Reconstruction protections after the Civil War. The Supreme Court has said if an officer violates the Constitution, the local government isn't automatically responsible, which is completely different from private companies. You know, if ABC Foods has a truck that runs you over, you're not going to sue the driver, right? You're going to sue ABC Foods.
Yeah.
They have the money. They have the resources. Mm-hmm. They have the ability to prevent something from happening in the future. But you can't do the same thing with the government. You have to prove that the government itself, the police department or the chief, themselves violated the Constitution, caused the constitutional violation of your rights.
Bizarre.
It's totally bizarre. And it makes it really difficult to get justice in these cases against governments. I talk in the book about the Vallejo Police Department. Vallejo's outside of Oakland, like 30 miles outside of Oakland. That department has killed more people between 2010 and 2020 per capita than any but one of the largest 100 police departments in the country.
Wow.
And they have 400 officers. 14 of them call themselves the Fatal 14. They've killed one or more people. And when they do, they have a little ceremony, like at a barbecue or at a bar, where they bend a corner of their badge.
Wow.
And that's been admitted by these officers.
Wow.
And that city has never been held to have caused the violations of any of their community members' rights.
That's a small police department. 100 officers is very small.
Very small.
And they've killed more people there than most other cities in America, much, much larger cities. And they have essentially a gang initiation when they do it, which is, we could get into police gangs as a real phenomenon. We have them here in Los Angeles. That is like a poisonous root system in that city. Like that must be facilitated and tolerated at the highest levels for that to exist.
I mean, and I should say none of the officers were disciplined or fired.
Of course not.
Right.
But also that's the level at which you should have the DOJ coming in and putting a consent decree on or something along like that is the most that's the most terrible possible situation for a police department. And nothing has happened in this city.
Well, to say nothing has happened is an overstatement. I mean, there's a lot that's trying to happen. Mm-hmm. In none of these lawsuits that have been filed, has there ever been a court that says, city, you should be held responsible for what's happening to your officers. The California AG's office is doing an investigation. Okay. Unclear, you know, how that's progressing and what impact it's having. There's massive amounts of community advocacy. You know, community groups are flooding the city council meetings and doing all that they can.
Yeah.
But you ask, why does this stuff not get changed? And there's
why is there not a lever for one of those community groups to actually push on to cause something to happen when, again, these are gross constitutional violations?
Right.
I can imagine being one of those community members being like, we're here. We've been talking about this for years. We've been pushing on that. Why the fuck does nothing happen?
Yeah, that is precisely what they are saying.
Yeah.
If you go to those meetings, and at some point you can have pressure, you can have advocacy, you can have oversight, you can have stern conversations from the AG's office. Eventually you need a consent decree. As you said, you need an order by a court saying you have to do this, you have to do that. And that hasn't yet happened. And in part, again, this all goes back to the Supreme Court that has made it very difficult in the name of states' rights and local governments' rights to bring claims directly against the city and also to bring claims to get what's called injunctive relief, which is like the forward-looking relief that you have to change policies, you have to change practices. That's another area of the law the Supreme Court has made very difficult to get past those barriers, again, out of these interests in states' rights, local governments governing themselves.
So, I mean, you're talking about 100 years of this sort of dating back to Reconstruction. And I can go back to the Reconstruction years and say, well, I know why they did it, because they were racist and they were trying to uphold white supremacy, and they privately liked the Ku Klux Klan, and maybe they wore little white hoods at night, you know, when no one was around, because it was the 18 whatevers. But, you know, over the course of 100 years with multiple different Supreme Court regimes that, as you said, going through the civil rights era as well, why would you see this persistent theme to constantly be protecting, you know, the police from any form of accountability? Like, what is there any reason in your view that the Supreme Court would constantly, you know, protect that over and over again? I know what a police union would do it. We're going to talk about police unions, but why would the Supreme Court have an interest in this?
Well, I mean, the Supreme Court is, I should say, first of all, I mean, the court has shifted in over time. You know, there's high marks and low marks. You know, after the law was passed in 1871, the Supreme Court, you know, was very against any protection of rights in 1961. And in the 60s, this is like the Earl Warren Court, which is the Supreme Court sort of high watermark in terms of a liberal court, added, you know, a number of different constitutional protections and strengthened the Constitution in various ways. And then, you know, since the late 1960s, the court has been dominated by conservatives who have then stripped away many of those protections. Why did they do it? I mean, you got to get the justices on this couch to try to get into their hearts and minds. But
because they think it's good when the police kill and injure Black Americans.
Of course they would never say that. But I think, again, you know, it's the interests of the government.
Yeah.
And also of business. I mean, you pointed to the hot coffee McDonald's litigation. I mean, I think the Roberts Court will go down, John Roberts, Chief Justice currently, as a very pro corporation, pro government court, that whether the point is that they actually want to, you know, put Black Americans and poor Americans under their thumb, I don't think that's, you know, what they wake up and go to sleep hoping and dreaming for necessarily. But, you know, in all of these cases, you know, there's a plaintiff and there's a defendant, right? And there's a V between them. And you know, and there's a question of whose rights are you going to preference?
Yeah.
And again and again and again, it's the government and it's corporate defendants.
Yeah.
And often based on these mythical, I believe, stories about, you know, what would happen if it was too easy to sue.
I mean, I know it's like, it can seem ludicrous to say I can look into their hearts and know how they feel, except when they rule the same way over and over again. And you can see what their priorities are. You know, that the idea that we need to protect the police from the people who they're killing or harming rather than the other way around. It's pretty obvious. I mean, it's the conversation we've had on the show many times. When you look at the overall thrust of the criminal justice system, well, nobody will say that it's too harm and oppress people of color or generally poor people in America. But when that's been the effect for the past couple hundred years, it's hard to not look at it and say, that sure seems like the point, because that's what it's doing.
You know, I will say, and I mean, this in some ways is part of the reason that I wrote this book and wrote it in the way that I did, is that I do think, and maybe this is just hopelessly naive of me, but I do think that compelling stories of real people whose lives have been turned upside down can have an effect where, you know, people in power, whether it be courts or legislators, can say, wow, this goes one step too far. And you know, there's a legal doctrine called qualified immunity that the Supreme Court has created. It's just awful. And it basically says that an officer can violate people's rights, and if you can't find a prior court decision with virtually identical facts, you're out of luck. But the Supreme Court in November of 2020 issued a decision in a case called Taylor versus Riojas, where they said, you know what? In this case, it's so obvious that this person's rights were violated, you don't need a prior case. And the court, even Sam Alito, who was like very, very conservative and very dismissive of these kinds of cases, said this was clearly unconstitutional. Any officer should have known that this was unconstitutional. Mm. And I mean, it was a horrifying case of a man held naked in a freezing cold cell in a prison with feces and human waste covering the cell mm-hmm. for 6 days. And I mean, this is an extreme case. But when you have Sam Alito saying, okay,
yeah,
here we've gone one step too far. This cannot be what we mean or what we want. You know, that shouldn't have to be the bar. It definitely shouldn't be the bar. But I do think that, you know, part of the reason I wrote the book in the way I did, which is sort of filled with human stories, is to say, if you believe in restricting people's rights in these ways, you have to be comfortable with the outcomes of these cases.
But is there, so look, I could look at this case you just told us about and say, well, that's maybe some progress, except that I worry about there being one or two exemplary cases where somebody is punished, right? In the intro, I talked about how, you know, Derek Chauvin was convicted, except that he was convicted at the end of a multi-month long largest civil rights demonstration in America in decades, where people spontaneously took to the streets. That's only going to happen once a decade or so,
right?
You know, and also along the way, first of all, it was the George Floyd case. The reason it was an explosion was it was exemplary of thousands of cases across the country.
Yes.
And then in the course of that protest, there were dozens and dozens of cases where the police did things where they were not prosecuted for them. I remember so vividly the elderly man in, I think, Buffalo, New York, where, and this was another piece of viral footage where like an elderly man who was protesting but not doing anything, you know, he was just sort of like standing still and police came towards him and he was just like, stop for a second. I don't remember what he said to them, but he was just like standing there and one of the police officers shoves him.
Yep.
He falls backwards. He hits his head. He starts bleeding on the street. It's horrifying footage. And the police just like walk around him and leave him there. Yeah. And it was so stunning. And you could watch the footage and say, there's no justification for the shove. There is at the very least a police officer you would imagine have some kind of duty to give medical attention to someone who's bleeding on the street, an elderly man. And my memory of the case is that nothing happened to those police officers. Maybe they were put on leave or something along those lines.
Yeah, I don't recall exactly what happened.
So we won't make any assertions that we are not positive about, but I'm pretty certain those police officers were not fired, were not sued, were not, convicted. And
whether or not they were, there's literally thousands of these cases that could be brought every year.
And so isn't there this risk of, you know, the Derek Chauvins of the world? Okay, we did it. We you know, front page of the New York Times, that one guy's in prison. Yep. But meanwhile, systemically, you know, this is still happening dozens of times a day.
I absolutely agree. I absolutely think so. And, you know, I'm regularly on panels with law enforcement folks, who say that very thing. Our systems, our disciplinary systems work. Yeah. Just look at Derek Chauvin or look at the people who killed Tyre Nichols. You know, those officers were immediately fired. They are criminally prosecuted. Look, our system works, but we cannot judge our system by how it treats the people who killed George Floyd and Tyre Nichols.
Yeah.
We have to judge our system by the cases that don't get that kind of massive press attention and outrage, because those cases far outnumber the ones that do get that kind of press attention. And those cases, the resolution of those cases look nothing like what happened and what's happening with George Floyd and Tyre Nichols.
Okay, well, I want to keep getting into this and talk a lot more about police unions specifically, but we got to take a really quick break. We'll be right back with more Joanna Schwartz. Folks, I'm honored to say that the podcast is sponsored this week by The Washington Post. If you're a Factually listener, you're already a person who aims to stay informed, aware, and engaged. But let me bring you in on a little secret. Beside the fantastic guests I have on this show, the number one way that I stay engaged is through reading the news like The Washington Post. Their journalists bring you the facts and provide clarity about what's happening on Capitol Hill, the economy, climate change, foreign policy, and everything else that I and you care about. You know, here on Factually, we love to go deep on topics, and The Washington Post helps me and helps you go deeper on the news that matters most to you.
That's why I start my days by warming up my brain by reading great articles from some of the best journalists out there in the Post. In fact, many of my favorite past guests on this show, like Taylor Lorenz and David Weigel, have contributed to the Washington Post. That's how good their journalists are. You know, I've also found that adding the Washington Post app to the home screen on my phone has been a great way to cut my social media time. Instead of scrolling through social media on the bus, I get to learn more about the world around me. It is absolutely incredible and makes that commute time so much more enjoyable and fruitful. I also love the Post's newsletters, like The 7, which is a quick commute read that they send each weekday morning and is also available as a podcast. I even signed up to get the Post's For You newsletter, which sends me my very own personalized roundup of stories every evening based on my interest in reading history. So if all of that sounds good to you, well, now is the time to sign up for The Washington Post. Go to WashingtonPost.com/factually to subscribe for just 50 cents a week for your first year. That is 80% off their typical offer. So this is truly a steal. Once again, that is WashingtonPost.com/factually to subscribe for just 50 cents a week for your first year. Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with samples. You know, I never used to have allergies, but then suddenly in my 30s, I started getting walloped with them every single spring. I'll step outside on a beautiful day, ready to hop on the bus or head down to the podcast studio, and suddenly I have a runny nose, scratchy eyes, and it makes it pretty hard to have a conversation with our guests when I am so bogged down and distracted with allergies. Well, luckily for those of us who live with those symptoms, which now includes me, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. This double action combination of prescription strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, a runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, an itchy nose and throat, and sinus congestion and pressure with ease. So when I've got a big interview with a big guest, I look for relief with Claritin D. In as little as 30 minutes, I'm refreshed, I'm renewed, and I no longer sound like some kind of cartoon duck. So if you are ready to live life as if you don't have allergies, it is time to live Claritin Clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. You can find Claritin D at your pharmacy counter, and you don't even need a prescription. So go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear. That's Claritin.com. Use as directed.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, we're back with Joanna Schwartz. Let's talk about police unions. As everybody knows, I'm a union man. Our last episode was about the Writers Guild strike. We are on strike right now. I believe very strongly in, you know, people coming together and fighting for their rights and making sure that they're not abused in the workplace. I believe that every worker deserves a union. The big problem for the progressive labor movement is police unions because, we have this awareness that police unions, they look out for their members, as they should, but they tend to look out for them in ways that hurt the rights of the people who those police officers are meant to be protecting at the very least. So tell me what your view of police unions are, and are they a problem for why these officers are never disciplined?
Okay, well, I'll take the second part of that first. They are absolutely a problem for why officers are not disciplined and fired. And I would say that at the same time that the Supreme Court was chirping about the dangers of too much justice through the court system, union officials in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and beyond were making the same kinds of arguments about the need to protect officers from unwarranted discipline, firings when they'd done nothing wrong. And union agreements within individual departments create all sorts of barriers to transparency to the public, barriers to investigating and disciplining and terminating officers, and these law enforcement officers' bills of rights that are enacted throughout the country not only make discipline and firing difficult, but they create all of these extra levels of review, even when a department decides to fire someone or take action, that end up meaning that those actions get reversed and officers get put back into their jobs. And even law enforcement officials say these protections are too strong. So, yes, I mean, not all of them, but there have been law enforcement chiefs, police chiefs who say part of our challenge is that when we want to fire people, we can't or we try and then it gets overturned. So police unions are a huge part of the problem. I think it's very challenging to be pro-union and to think about how it relates to the police. But I guess I would say a couple things. One is that when you think about union, many other kinds of union agreements, they are creating protections against the corporate, you know, the corporate entity who's trying to shove down wages, whatever else. A lot of the work that police unions have been doing is essentially pushing down further the people that they are policing, right?
Yeah, it's making protecting them from the public, not from, say, the mayor or, you know, the budget cutters at City Hall.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The second difference that I would offer up is that certainly as we've seen with the current strike, with the writers and with union action throughout our history, is that it's very difficult for unions to maintain power now, to get power to demand the kinds of things that they want. Police unions don't seem to have that trouble.
They do not have that problem.
And, you know, part of it may be because, again, what they're asking for is protections against, you know, the people who they're trying to police.
The people who have the least power in our society.
And so, part of the problem to me is what unions are asking for. Another part of the problem is what local governments and state legislatures are giving them.
Uh-huh.
You know, these are negotiations. These union agreements are negotiated and agreed to by local governments and the union. So part of the problem is what the union's asking for. And part of the problem is what the local governments, what the city or the city council or the mayor is letting them have.
Yeah. Is there is the existence of a police union period always going to be, you know, inimical in that way? Or is it, you know, a cultural problem in what those unions are asking? Because look, again, I'm a proud unionist. You know, I believe in the importance of workers getting together and having their power. I also know not every union under the sun has done the right thing in every circumstance. Plenty of dark stains on the labor movement over the last 100 years, where, you know, for instance, some unions use their power to exclude certain types of workers from a workforce rather than including them and bettering their working conditions, things of that nature. So is it a matter of could there be such a thing as a reformed police union that is focusing on the right things? Or is there, you know, something structural in the problem, you know, in that institution that is always going to lead to a lack of accountability? Are police somehow different from other workers in a way that, you know, because I've heard that argument made, that, you know, police are the one type of worker who should not have a union because they are, you know, the wielders of violence against, you know, other citizens in a way no one else is. I know it's a very complicated question, but
it is a complicated question. And you know, I'm not although I support unions, I wouldn't say I'm like an expert in all of this. But here's one way I would think about it. It strikes me that you could keep police unions, but limit the kinds of things that they could negotiate.
Yeah.
So again, if we sort of keep with this general idea, negotiating salaries, negotiating, various terms of employment seems very different from negotiating about the transparency and availability of disciplinary records or how long the department can keep disciplinary records.
Yeah.
And what I've heard anecdotally is that local governments you know, mayors, city councils have been willing to, and unions have as well, been willing to negotiate down salaries in exchange for these other protections.
Wow.
So again, the city is thinking, we don't want to have to pay a 10% salary increase or whatever it is. Okay, we'll give you less transparency and less oversight as the, as the negotiating tool.
See, from the union perspective, you'd say, well, that's a fine deal because we can go get the money next year. You know, we can go back and get the salary bump. But if we've won a persistent protection against any sort of accountability, then we've won that forever. And we can go back and get our 1%, next budget negotiation or whatever.
Right. And I think that there's an argument that doing that is unconstitutional.
Yeah.
I mean, it certainly results in the violation of people's rights. But even, very basically, criminal defendants have the entitlement to see discipline, evidence of that an officer may be untruthful, may have, lied before. And if those records through union agreements are being destroyed or not protected or not turned over, those are agreements that are potentially, indirectly leading to the violation of people's constitutional rights.
And so now let's talk about the political piece of it, because I think that's where we really start to see it. You're talking about district attorneys being unwilling to prosecute police officers because they need to work with the police department. And actually here in L.A., we had a turnover in our district attorneys. The former county district attorney, Jackie Lacey, was booted out primarily because in the wake of George Floyd, you had a huge campaign against her. Of activists saying she refuses to prosecute cops who kill. And yet our new district attorney, George Gascon, who's been a guest on the show, has also had some difficulty prosecuting those police officers. It's not always, there's been a couple cases where he said, I can't actually make this prosecution, et cetera. It seems to be a fraught thing for the justice system to enforce, period, because it's essentially trying to enforce it against itself. Is that a deep structural issue, or is there a way around it?
Well, it is absolutely a deep structural issue. And it's true. The problem can be, and when we first talked about it, I described the problem being prosecutors who don't want to prosecute their own. That's a bit of a quick gloss. And the problems are much deeper than that. As I think George Gascon has talked about, the problem, even if you're a motivated prosecutor to do this, the law itself, what the criminal laws are that you can charge officers with, have extremely high standards. And then whether it's a grand jury system where a grand jury is deciding whether to indict or a jury that's deciding whether to convict, jurors tend to be very sympathetic to officers.
Right.
So it's not just about getting a prosecutor who's motivated. It's all of these other steps as well. The challenges of proving what the, heightened standard is in these cases and then convincing a jury. Are there ways around that? Well, I mean, one thing that's being done in parts of the country is having a prosecutor other than the local prosecutor decide whether to bring these charges, whether it's going to a state AG or someone who's not so reliant on these.
And that's why when there actually is enforcement here, you'll see it from the state or maybe from the feds rather than the county or the city.
Right. In some cases, for sure. As far as making it easier to, changing the laws, that strikes me as difficult. And as far as the juries go, it's interesting. And I think we're going to see how things play out over the next several years. I think it's hard to get this data about how often prosecutions happen or about how jurors people feel about the cops, but certainly post 2020, I feel like we've at least seen more stories about prosecutions of cops and more stories about convictions.
Yeah.
And I do think that people are becoming more skeptical.
Sentiment towards the police has changed to some degree, and actually we should get into that, but I also recall last time that I went far enough in the jury selection process to be like they're excluding and including people. I seem to recall one of the questions being, Well, have you ever had a negative interaction with a police officer that would make you biased against the police? Which, like, I don't know, that seems like a pretty reasonable way for a citizen to feel. If they've had a negative interaction with a police officer, hey, there's a time I got stopped and frisked and I did nothing wrong. And so I kind of don't trust the police all the time. Well, they literally try to exclude you from the jury if you feel that way. Whereas if you watch Law and Order every week, you know, and you love your Brooklyn Nine-Nine and you're like, oh yeah, I love Andy Samberg. He's a nice cop. And so is everybody else. Then you get to be on the jury. That's a phenomenon, right?
100%. I have a whole chapter about juries in Shielded. And part of what I talk about is the various ways in which people get excluded from juries ends up meaning that people who might be most sympathetic to plaintiffs in these cases are cut out of the jury process. So like in federal juries, which is where a lot of these civil rights cases come, you're excluded if you are a felon, if you've ever been convicted of a felony. For life, you're excluded. Wow. So, and you know, the percentage of, I mean, because of racist policing and racist criminal prosecution, who disproportionately is excluded? Black men.
Yep.
Then you're excluded if you're not a registered voter. Then, you know, to get a jury summons, you have to have a stable address, where the questionnaire is sent.
Right. You have to be able to show up.
You have to have the time to fill it out and the time to send it in and the time to show up.
Yeah.
And then after all of that, you get asked questions about whether you've ever had a negative experience with police.
Right.
And can get excluded if you say you have. So,
this is selecting for people who have probably never had an experience with the police. This is like what you've described is a process that selects the affluent person who lives in the suburbs, who sees, you know, the nice patrol car drive by once a week and is like, hello, officer. And, you know, and has never, ever suffered from the kind of, you know, violation of their constitutional rights that so many other Americans had. Those Americans don't get the opportunity to serve on juries. I never even fucking thought of that. That's incredible.
It is. And if you go to your jury room, you know, if you go to jury service, particularly in federal courts, because federal courts have a broader geographic area. Mm-hmm. So like if you're in L.A. going to the state jury service, the county, it's just limited to L.A. County.
Yeah.
You might see a more diverse group of people. But if you're in the federal system, that's Simi Valley. That's, you know, that's sort of all stretches of the Central District of California. It's a lot of white people and it's a lot of people who are not living in the city.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, there are judges who've made comments. It's not about L.A. or California, but saying like we're in Detroit and we're in the federal courthouse. And there's barely any black people in the jury pool. And that's just simply not a representative jury. The whole point of a jury is to have a jury of one's peers, a representative community of lay people who can assess your case.
It's
messed up.
Okay, so Joanna, let's move to what the fuck we do about this, because what we're describing here, right, is the state systematically violating Americans' constitutional rights and layer upon layer of system that is designed to stop that from being ameliorated or, you know, punished in any way. And a criminal justice system that is designed root and branch to exclude the voices and the power of the people who it's doing it to.
Yeah.
Right. And again, when I have these conversations about criminal justice, I look at it and I go, that seems like it's designed from the beginning in order to do that.
Yep.
It's impossible to look at it anyway once you're holding it all in your mind, as I often am, 45 minutes into an interview like this.
Yeah.
And so now we get into what we do about it. There's a lot of movements around criminal justice right now. There's reform. I tend to use the phrase criminal justice reform. There's also folks who are abolitionists because they believe that the entire system is so corrupt that that's the only approach that they can see to take towards it. I'm curious what prescriptions you make in your book right here. Is there a chapter at the end where it says, well, that's the glossary.
No, there is. It's chapter 13, okay. Unlucky chapter 13. It's called A Better Way. And
great. Tell me about it. I got to hear it because I am in a dark place right now.
Well, look, I'm in a dark place too. And, you know, I understand and very sympathetic to the idea that you could just like go into the bunker and shut the door and take your like family size bag of Cheetos and just wait for, you know, wait for the end to come. But I'm, you know, I that couldn't be the last chapter of the book. So I do talk about a lot of different possible reforms. Look, I think that the way that we make the system better in broad terms are at the front end, making it less likely that police interact with people when they don't need to. Okay.
Sorry. Let's just let them sit by themselves and not, if they just didn't ever talk to anybody, that would be great. I just love that version
but,
of it.
I mean, what I'm saying is a version of abolition, right? Yeah. Or defund. Like what folks who want abolition or defund is to invest in other parts of our society.
Yes.
Unarmed, you know, unarmed people responding to people in mental health crises, you know, building up education, et cetera, so that we don't need police. I'm more of an incrementalist. I'm more of a, you could call me a radical incrementalist. If you want to aim towards the final goal of defund or abolish or limit the footprint of policing, part of it is having fewer contacts.
Yeah.
And you know, there's ways in which police want that too.
I mean,
LA's police union in March came out with a statement that said, we don't want to be responding to people in mental health crisis. We don't want to be responding to homeless people who are peeing on the street. We don't want to respond to people who are in traffic accidents where nobody's injured. And great. You know, let's fund other programs, other people who don't have guns to do those things.
And this is what, by the way, a lot of people who describe themselves as abolitionists will tell you that that is what abolition means to them. It's a long-term view of, if we are able to put all of those other processes, all those other teams in place, then we may not need policing the way that we have it today. In the same way that, you know, I think when people describe themselves as slavery abolitionists 200 years ago, they were taking that long view. And one of the best things that's ever been said to me on this show, talking to the wonderful writer and scholar James Forman Jr., and asked him how he felt about the phrase defund. And he said, and I repeat this all the time, I'll never forget it. He said, the only problem with that is we shouldn't be leading with what we're taking away, because that frightens people.
Yep.
We should be leading with what we're putting in place instead, with those mental health response teams. If you go to anybody in Los Angeles or anywhere else and who's afraid about the phrase defund the police, and you say, actually, what we need is mental health teams rather than police addressing, everyone agrees with that. Because we've experienced, I mean, I think I've told this story on the show before. I was, experience I had walking down the street in Los Angeles at like 11 p.m. at night, walking home from the subway stop. And there was a woman in some great distress and she was shouting, help, help, you know? And I was like, ma'am, what do you need? And she just kept shouting, help, help. I was like, oh, I can't help her. I walk a block down the street. I see two police officers. I say, oh, thank God. Folks, like, sir, ma'am, there's a woman down the street yelling help. And they said to me, oh, she's just crazy. That's what they said. And I was like, what the fuck? I mean, there's a woman shouting help. She was in a fucking nightgown on the street. You know what I mean? This is a woman in distress who needed help. Yes, she was crazy. She still needed help. And these officers did not have the tools to. And I'm like, all right, so why the fuck are we paying for them to be there if they can't help her? Clearly, and I think so many people in LA have had that experience.
Oh, yeah.
Why is no one being helped in this situation? So I very much agree with that. I think you can have that incrementalist approach and still be working towards that eventual goal of saying, if we put these programs in place and we see that they work, then we'll be able to shift the resources over. I'm on board with that. However, when we live in a world where we have this incredibly complex and incredibly carceral criminal justice system that is clearly designed to lock up the powerless, the poor, the different, the people who are not normative, the non-white affluent person. And we've built it over the past couple hundred years. I mean, politically, are we going to be able to get there? Because we have all of these forces, unions, there's people in America who simply like these policies. You know, they thirst for blood. They like to see people who they don't like locked up. We've got the weight of inertia. We've got the, 200 years of Supreme Court decisions. you know, that's what starts to make me a little bit. Please speak to my doom here.
Well, I guess I would say, you know, what's the option? What's the alternative? Because, the system is completely stacked against justice, in my view, in every dimension. But I can't just like take that and then say, well, I guess we're fucked. You know, I mean, that doesn't seem like
all you can do is wake up and fight another day.
And I do think that finding, you know, it's definitely not as sexy as saying abolish the police, to say interest convergence, find ways in which the police and the public can agree. That's not a very, you know, that is a dissatisfying answer from the perspective of it's a dissatisfying prescription when the disease is what you've described. It's like a cancer all over the body. And then what I'm saying is, have you tried, you know, more vitamin C? Or, you know, it doesn't feel like it's a response that's meeting the harm. But I also think that chipping away is how, you know, as how changes have been made throughout. You know, as you said, it's not like abolitionists of slavery just said, abolish slavery in, you know, and then it happened.
Well, then where are we going to get the cotton from? Like, no, it is like, you know, there were steps along the way to this. It was a long-term goal.
Yes. But it you know, saying take little steps, take advantage of opportunity, like the opportunity around the fact that people seem generally to agree that police are doing too much and that they shouldn't have to do all of these things.
I guess the problem with the slavery comparison, which we're making, and I think is very apt, is that it took a war to eventually end it. There were the incremental steps, but it also took, you know, the federal government to say, hold on a second, we need to fight a war over this. We need to kill each other in order to end this. And that's my concern. But
it didn't end. I mean, you know, how many books have been written about the fact that slavery ended and then slavery by another name, you know,
I mean, we talked about the Reconstruction period and those Supreme Court decisions, which were part of that story.
So we have, you know, it's not like there's injustice and then there's some switch that you flip and then there's justice. There's no golden age of accountability that you're going to get through some shift. But, you know, part of what I'm talking about in Shielded is how many different barriers there are, not just on the, you know, my focus is on the back end, you know, so we've been talking about reducing police interactions on the front end. On the back end, you have to have accountability and justice when they violate the law. And that's where all of these barriers are that we've been talking about. So you start chipping away at some of those barriers and the system gets incrementally better. Does it address all of the problems? No, I mean, no. But, you know, as we said, like, what's the alternative?
When you say finding common cause or like finding these places where incentives meet with the individual members of the police themselves or police unions, I'm curious if you find any prospect for doing that, because a lot of the time when I look at the way individual police officers behave and the way police unions behave, I look at that and I say they're terrified. That's the fundamental, like, emotional thing that's happening is, like, why do the police pull out guns and shoot people at a moment's notice? It's because they're terrified they're going to get shot. It's fundamentally a fear response. And part of that comes from the fact there's guns everywhere in America. And that's, like, just the ambient, well, anybody could have a gun at any time, so you better shoot them right away. But, you know, even when you look at the unions, we said they're protecting themselves from the people they're policing. That's who they're afraid of. They have that mentality of they're going into a war zone and they have to protect themselves. And so to me, sometimes when I'm like lying awake at night thinking about this, it looks like it might be possible to make the argument that like the structure of policing doesn't serve your members. And rather than protecting yourselves from the system, you need to make common cause and change the system. If I were to imagine a police union that is actually progressive and making progress on that, I can almost think my way to that, you know, but that is the largest cultural shift I can possibly imagine. Is that something that you think is possible or a conversation that we could have? Because if any police officer wants to come on and talk about this, I'm happy to, you know?
Yeah, I mean,
I'm happy to start it.
I absolutely agree with you. And I think there is, you know, I'm an optimist to my own detriment, I think. But I think that there are ways of seeing that kind of shift. So for example, qualified immunity, again, it's a protection for individual officers. And it's been justified based on this myth that officers are personally responsible for settlements and judgments in these cases, which is simply not true. Officers virtually never pay anything. Mm-hmm. And it's not because of qualified immunity. It's because of agreements.
So even if it weren't for qualified immunity, qualified immunity is protecting nothing, because even if it weren't for that, there would be no prosecution or penalty anyway.
There wouldn't be a penalty. Well, it's that even if there's a finding, there's these things called indemnification agreements around the country that provide that if an officer is sued, you will be given a lawyer and a settlement or judgment will be paid by the city.
Yeah.
Okay. So that has nothing to do with qualified immunity. Mm-hmm. It's a totally different protection. But the rhetoric, and I think it's a rhetoric that officers believe, is that they're one lawsuit away from bankruptcy,
uh-huh.
you know, just because of that's what's being said, unless they have qualified immunity.
Yeah.
So in the last sort of rounds of debates around the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, which was offered by Congress that would have ended qualified immunity, people like Tim Scott and Lindsey Graham, conservative Republicans, who are completely opposed to getting rid of qualified immunity, said, okay, how about you just bring lawsuits directly against the city instead to protect officers from being bankrupted?
Mm.
And my response is, okay. Sounds great to me, Lindsey and Tim. Let's talk, because these officers aren't paying anyway.
Yeah.
So yeah, you want to just allow claims directly against the local government who, you know, they don't have qualified immunity. I'll take that deal any day. But it's a deal that I think some Republicans think is a good idea because it's protecting officers.
Mm.
It's protecting officers' bank accounts, their pocketbooks. And so, you know, I do think that officers and the local governments don't necessarily have exactly the same interests.
Yeah.
And I would absolutely find ways to create allegiances with officers to get at the systemic problems.
So if you're trying to create a systemic reform, you can occasionally say, okay, I think I can make common cause with a police union, such as putting in place a mental health team.
Sure.
That's like a case in which even an avowed abolitionist could work with a police union, or there might be some other cases like that. And I've heard of such cases. There have been conversations like that in Los Angeles, I've heard.
Yeah.
But I've also heard of, I mean, I believe I've heard this anecdotally that like Los Angeles, for instance, has paid out millions in the kind of lawsuits that you're talking about with the police abusing people. I guess that sort of thing does happen in L.A.
Oh, yeah.
Certainly hasn't changed anything about how policing is waged here or how much money the police get. It's just like an expense that ends up being borne by the taxpayer to pay millions out to the victims of abuse when the police go out and, you know, set off fireworks, a truckload of fireworks in the middle of a crowded street in L.A., as they did a year or two ago. They just end up like, all right, well, the city foots the bill.
Yep.
So fuck it. Right.
Yep.
There's a risk there as well. But at the very least, the systemic the people in charge of creating the systemic problem are having to pay out. So it's some.
I mean, I think it can help. And part of one thing I have a chapter about that, too, in the book. And one thing I talk about is the value of taking settlements and judgments out of police departments' mm-hmm. budgets, which doesn't happen in L.A. And actually, the sheriff's department does this, but not the LAPD.
We should be taking the money from the police department.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, it's still, I mean, one thing that people don't realize is they talk about the millions and millions of dollars that are paid in these cases. The payouts are less than 1% of most local governments' budgets mm-hmm. and far less than 1%. And mm-hmm. you compare that to a quarter or a third or more right. of the city's budget that is the police department
yeah.
budget. You know, people complain about the millions of dollars spent in these cases that could have been used to fund community centers and fix roads and all of those things. Well, maybe that's true, but maybe we should be looking at the 40% of the city's budget that's taken up with the police department and yeah. maybe think about where we can take some of that money away. But just it would still be a relative drop in the bucket for police departments to pay settlements and judgments from their budgets.
Yeah.
But the risk managers for police departments I've talked to who do that say at least it gives them some incentive, some reason to just take a peek at these cases and think, and could say, we have done something different?
Send a memo out. Hey, maybe could everybody read the warrant? You know, because that might help save us all some money. And then we could throw you a pizza party at the end of the year.
Exactly.
With the money we save on all the lawsuits that we don't have to pay out because you didn't like accidentally almost murder an 80-year-old man because you read the fucking warrant.
Correct. It seems straightforward, right?
It seems pretty straightforward. it never fails to boggle my mind how far the distance is between what we are taught about how the criminal justice system, how the Constitution is supposed to work in this country, and how it literally does, that the government violates Americans' constitutional rights every day, and there is no current legal mechanism to actually ameliorate that or to punish the people who do it, is still shocking to me. For folks who are similarly shocked and want to fucking do something about it, is there anything that you suggest people do?
Well, one thing I would say is that, I've lost most faith in the Supreme Court and Congress.
We all have.
But state and local governments are a really interesting place for reform. And, people can get their city council members' attention, and there are really, really basic things to ask for. For example, on the front end and on the back end, you know, there's moves in LA and Philadelphia and other places around the country to limit traffic stops by cops, to limit, the kinds of things that cops do with their time. But also on the back end, advocacy to get the city council to budget in the settlements and judgments cost into police departments' budgets. That's something that the city council could do. Another thing the city council could do is make their departments or do themselves analysis of the settlements and judgments in these cases to try to, make changes that will prevent things from happening in the future. There are departments across the country that have these outside auditors who look at the cases and find trends in them and say, hey, you're entering into people's houses without a warrant. You're not supposed to do that. And it actually, that training can actually make a difference. But those are changes that can happen at the local level. People can go to their city councils. People can actually make those changes happen. And I think that there's, all the focus has been on qualified immunity, this really hot button issue. A lot less attention has been paid to local government budgeting. It's a little bit less of a, sexy topic, but in fact, that's an opportunity because it means that people can think rationally about this and perhaps, make sensible choices.
Yeah. And here in LA, we've had a lot more focus on local government from both activists, but also the public have really started to take notice.
Yep.
And we have a new crop of reformers in our city council, and there are starting to be changes slowly, but we're starting to see them to some extent. And at the very least, there's a conversation being had that our local police department is having to deal with, having to reckon with and negotiate with. And that at the very least has changed. It's where I constantly preach the importance of participating in state, but particularly local government, because those are the people who really affect your lives.
And I think it's important also in terms of maintaining hope. It's very easy to say, although painful to say, nothing's changed in the past 150 years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, things have changed. Yeah. I mean, things have changed since Rodney King.
Multiple civil rights movement in that time, and things have changed.
And there's four steps forward and two steps back and one step to the side and then one step forward again. Like, change is not, like a jet plane taking off. But why should we be surprised? I mean, of course, when people are trying to advance civil rights against the government, it's not going to be an easy path. But, that doesn't mean that you don't keep walking it and finding other ways forward.
Just like, again, when I talk to abolitionists, people who describe themselves as abolitionists today, they make the point that people were abolitionists in regards to slavery for hundreds of years. That was people were people grew up and died, and then their kids were abolitionists and they grew up and died before slavery was finally abolished. And, you know, but that doesn't mean they gave up, and they, I'm sure they said, oh my God, this is going to be so hard to change. But then one day it did. Right.
Yeah.
And all we can do is wake up and wage that battle every day. Joanna, thank you so much for being here.
It was my great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you once again to Joanna Schwartz for coming on the show. If you want to pick up a copy of her book, you can get it at factuallypod.com/books. And when you do, you'll be supporting not just this show, but your local bookstore as well. If you want to support the show directly, head to patreon.com/AdamConover. Just $5 a month gets you every episode ad free. And if you want to come see me on tour, I'm headed to Chicago. I'm going to be in St. Louis later this year. I'm going to be in Baltimore, Maryland. Head to adamconover.net for tickets and tour dates. I want to thank Tony Wilson and Sam Roudman for producing and editing the podcast with me, and everyone at HeadGum for making this possible. You can find me online at Adam Conover or at adamconover.net. And until next week, we'll see you on Factually. Thank you so much for listening.
That was a HeadGum podcast.